Akshay, did you always knew what you wanted to do when you passed out from MBA?
I was all over the place. Saurabh, what about you?
Yaar, meko to tab bhi idea nahi tha, aaj bhi idea nahi hai.
Confused about your career choices? Wondering what steps to take next? In this podcast called Beyond Campus, Saurabh Garg, founder of C4E, and Akshay Dutt, founder of Unnati, are on a mission to crack open the career success code for the youth. Wo bachpan mein kehte the na, tum jo chahe ban sakte ho. So, let's turn the dream into reality.
Hi everyone, this is Dhruv Nath. I used to be a professor. Now I'm an angel investor, a mentor, and an author.
I'm sure we all have a favorite professor in college. Someone who inspires us to have big dreams and chase lofty goals. For a lot of people at MDI, this role was played by Professor Dhruv Nath. He joined as a faculty member in MDI Gurgaon after almost two decades in the corporate world with NIIT, where he did just about everything and was also responsible for incubating a startup within NIIT. Professor Dhruv Nath is a director at Lead Angels Network, a consultant with multiple MNCs, and a very successful published author. Listen on as Akshay Dutt decodes the secrets to building a successful startup with Professor Dhruv Nath.
For our listeners who are not aware, 20 or roughly 20 years ago is when I first met Professor Dhruv Nath, when he just joined MDI, the very first year when he joined MDI, I was lucky enough to be there. So, sir, but let's start with your own education. Like, you know, where did you study from and were you very academically oriented?
So, yes, I was actually academically oriented, but I also enjoyed life. So, my schooling was actually done in a very small place near Shimla. It's called Solan, right? So, in the hill, a cute little place.
Mm-hmm. It's an apple growing region.
More than apple, actually, it is stone fruit, which means peaches, plums, apricots, right? So, after that, I went to IIT Delhi, where I did my BTech, electrical engineering. And then I also did my doctorate in computer science, again from IIT Delhi. So that's my background.
Okay. So IIT, you did like a fairly long stint of BTech and then
yes,
your PhD.
Yes, about 5 years plus 3.5 years. Yeah.
Why PhD? Like you were like looking at a career in academics. Was that the goal? Yeah.
Yes. So let me put it like this. I have always been somewhat inclined towards academics, number one. Number two, teaching is something which is always interesting. And I find when you teach, you learn. And my family has had a lot of academicians, so it was in the blood. But you know what happened interestingly is, once I finished my PhD, I realized at that time that, look, in academics, the quantum of money you get is actually fairly minuscule. And at that time, it used to be very, very tiny. So I realized, you know, at some stage, I need to get married, need to start a family. Family ko bhi khana hai kuch. I mean, you can't tell them, look, I have a professor salary, therefore, this is all you'll get. So, which is why, even though I had done a doctorate in preparation for a career in academics, I moved into industry. So I actually joined NIIT. And I was there for about 20 years. And then I moved back into academics. So, yes, the interest was always there. But in between, I took a short 20-year stint in industry, which actually was great because I learned a hell of a lot, you know.
So, you joined NIIT in what capacity? Like a faculty there or like?
Yeah, actually not as a faculty. You know, when I joined, it was more or less a startup. It was about, I think, 6 months old when I joined. So, in a startup, you do everything, right? So, I was, yes, I was also teaching. I was also doing some, we were creating some computer-based training courses, right? So, I was into that. Then, I was doing a very large amount of consulting for various clients. And then, I did some software development. Yeah.
NIIT, of course, is one of the pioneering tech startups of India, although usko wo recognition nahi milti as being a pioneering tech startup, but uski origin story kya thi? Matlab, you joined in 6 months of starting, so I'm sure you have a ringside view of how it started up and scaled up.
So actually, you know, this was started off, the biggest shareholder was Shiv Nadar, who was the, well, almost, well, till recently, the chairman of HCL Tech and the founder of HCL. Right? So Shiv Nadar, you know, he's a visionary, and he kept looking for newer and newer pastures, right? So he had started HCL at that time, and he said, look, this market of computer education, computer training is absolutely virgin. There's no significant player in this. So why don't we start this, right? So Pawar, R.S. Pawar, who used to be a management trainee, senior management trainee at HCL, Shiv Nadar told him, look, why don't you, you know, do a little bit of research on this and start this. So Pawar, along with a class fellow of his called Vijay Thadani, both from IIT, by the way, both my seniors, they started this, and it boomed for the first many, many years. It really boomed. And then, you know, in about, I think, 3-4 years, what they realized was, we are into education, but there is a hell of a lot more that we can do. So we got into consulting. We got into software development. And in fact, as of today, the software development division is far, far bigger than the education division, although it's now been sold off. So yes, it's been multiple things, multiple kinds of services in the IT industry. And I think they've had a good innings, at least in the first, I would say, 15, 16 years. Then, you know, in the dot-com crash, most IT companies went down. So this also went down.
So you were directly working with Pawar and Thadani. Like, was it like a very startup kind of a environment in those days?
Absolutely. And I think that's the benefit of working in a startup. If you have a great founder, you get a chance to work with him directly. And I learned a hell of a lot from both of these people, particularly from R.S. Pawar.
Okay. But obviously, I mean, I think the credit goes to Nadar for being so gutsy to take a bet on a management trainee to start up a whole new company.
No, so by then Pawar was not a management trainee. I mean, he had spent about 3-4 years in, I think, sales and product management at HCL Tech. But Shiv Nadar had this ability of identifying great people and giving them full ownership. Was, you run the company, I will fund it. So that's how it started.
Okay. Which is quite ahead of his time. I mean, that was the era when it was like a very much central command kind of an era for corporates in those days.
Absolutely, yeah. So he used to give full freedom to these people to run their companies, but he was he and his family were the largest shareholders.
Okay. So what all roles did you play? Like, you know, how did you contribute to the growth in those 19, 20 years that you spent there?
Okay, actually, lots of things. See, one of the big pluses of a company like that is that, unlike, let's say, TCS or, you know, Larsen & Toubro or ITC, where you get into a role and you grow within that role, here, every 2 or 3 years, I kept jumping roles. So I got into completely different roles. So it was almost like being in the same company, but actually working in about 8 or 10 different companies, which was, again, phenomenal learning. So I think it's been very, very positive. So I did some teaching. I think a large chunk of my work was in consulting. So I had the good the opportunity to do a lot of consulting with some big names, you know, Nestle, Glaxo, Gillette, Indian Oil, Indian Railways. So spent a lot of time, and again with senior management over there. One thing which I did, and that I did on my own, is I started a division called NIS, which is the National Institute of Sales, right? So I started that and I ran that for about 3 years and then moved out. And I think if I were to look back, that is the one biggest contribution to NIT, because that was a completely virgin field. You know, there are a lot of organizations which offer training programs for salespeople, you know, 1 week short program, 2 week short program, 3 day program, and so on. But there is actually nobody who offers a career course for a guy who wants to get into sales. So let's say a 1 year evening course. That is what we started. And it actually took off fairly well. Feedback was very positive. So that I think was fun. But I would say, Akshay, more or less everything I did there was fun. Because it never became boring, because every 2-3 years I would be in a different role. And I think that's the beauty of, you know, small, flexible organizations like this, as against, let's say, a Hindustan Lever or a TCS or an Infosys.
So, talking of NIS, why did it eventually get shut down? Matlab, wo scale up kyun nahi hua? Because you're right, sales is a skill which, being in the recruitment industry, I know that most clients are ready to pay whatever needed for good sales talent, because that's where the revenue comes from. So, this course logically should have become extremely like a popular de facto way of building a career in sales. So, hua kyun nahi?
Absolutely. Okay. So, I'll give you two reasons. Firstly, it didn't shut down. I'll explain what happened. By the way, at some stage, I think after I left NIT, it was finally bought over by Anil Ambani, the Reliance ADAG group, right? So it hasn't shut down, but it's essentially being used for internal training now. There's no external, it's not a business division anymore. So let me explain. It's a very interesting experience I had. You know, the course that we developed, and it was unique because there was no other similar course, feedback was very good. There was no problem at all, right? We also spoke to a lot of senior guys in industry. And they said, wonderful, we absolutely require something like this. Because, you know, if you look at an organization, a typical organization, so let's say look at Hindustan Lever, they would have about 40 to 50 guys in marketing, product management, sitting in the HO, right? But they probably have about 10,000 to 15,000 guys in the field who are selling. Right, and that's probably true of most organizations. So the huge numbers that are required are in sales and typically field sales. But unfortunately, if you look at MBA institutes, and I know you're also an MBA, but I still say this. If you look at MBA institutes, they prepare students for those 50 jobs, not for those 10 to 15,000 jobs. So there is a huge disconnect. And this is the disconnect that we were trying to fill. And the feedback from industry was phenomenal. Oh, wonderful, great. You know, and they gave us letters saying we will absorb your people. And they actually did on very, very good salaries. And, you know, these are multinational. So we said, bahut badhiya, which means we are now offering great careers to youngsters in top-notch companies, right? Companies like Nestle, companies like Levers, companies like Colgate, Gillette and co. This should run. However, what we realized interestingly was we had two customers. Customer one was the guy who was recruiting, which is the company. Customer two was the young guy who was paying and going through the course. The interesting thing we realized, and this we realized a little over time, was that people did not want a sales career. This was not a preferred option, right? People said, look, I'm very happy being a marketing guy. I'm very happy doing whatever, production, design, sales.
Sales badnaam career.
Exactly. And, you know, we've also spoken to some parents of girls. They say, look, we don't want to get our daughters married off to sales guys. That was the time that, arranged marriages were happening. Now, of course, marriages don't happen at all. Now it's only live-in. But anyway, let's keep that aside for a different podcast. So, that is the problem we found. And, you know, I've realized that changing a mindset which is so deeply entrenched is not easy. It takes years and years and years, if not more, maybe decades. And we found that, therefore, growth was slow. So, corporate training picked up very well. But growth in this kind of, the education, 1 year course, that was slow. So, which is why ultimately we shut down this division and the corporate training continued, which is what finally was bought over by Anil Ambani. But I would expect, Akshay, I think we were ahead of our time. So, had we started maybe 10 years back, so let's say in 2010, the requirement for sales guys has boomed even more. And, you know, these are not sales guys who are on their bicycles going to, remote interiors. these are sales guys in retail outlets, right, in malls. These are now, these are again price jobs. So had we started a little later when this revolution had come in, the retail revolution, I expect we would have done very well. So we are probably far ahead of our time.
Okay. So when you quit NIT at that time, like by like what kind of level were you at and what made you want to move on?
So I was a senior vice president, and the reason why I moved out was, okay, it's very interesting again. So firstly, I always liked academics. I like to teach. I don't do too much research, by the way. But the one thing I really, see, I have always been very, very keen to learn and to get my own hands dirty, right? What happened was, as a senior vice president, I was a very senior guy in the company, right? So I had people reporting to me and people reporting to them and to them and so on, right? And all the fun, all the hands-on work was being done by guys who were two or three levels below me, right? I was doing either the people management or the selling. And I said, boss, this is not what I want to do in life. My purpose is not to manage people. Or I actually want to do things on my own, right? So that was one. And of course, the other thing is I got a little sick of chasing business targets. I said, look, I mean, this is not really my cup of tea. And I have never been a great guy at getting business. So I said, look, academics, I like doing it, and let me go back. So that's how I decided. And I must tell you, it took a hell of a long time to convince my wife, but she finally agreed. It took an even longer time to convince my in-laws, because their reaction was, damad pagal ho gaya. I mean, you know, when we got our daughter married, he had a decent job. Kya ho gaya isko? So anyway, finally, they whether they relented or not, I joined MDI, and it's again been fun. Last 19 odd years have been a lot of fun.
Okay. So what was MDI like when you joined it? And, you know, again, you've been an instrumental part in the growth and evolution of MDI also. So tell us a bit about that.
So if you look at the evolution, I think what has happened is, firstly, it was much, much smaller. Right. It was, I think we had about two batches PGP. We had a few part time. In fact, we probably didn't have part time students at that time at all. If I remember right. And today we have all kinds of different programs, right? We have the part-time program, we have the PGP HR program, we have the international PGP program. So I think MDI has grown both in terms of numbers and in terms of kinds of offering very, very significantly. So absolutely no issues. I must tell you a couple of other things about MDI, my innings at MDI, and maybe I'm preempting a question. I think, you know, one of the biggest plus points of my 19 years at MDI has been my meeting and interacting with students like you and, of course, alumni. So, I mean, as a student, I'd meet them. Then later on, I'd meet them as alumni. And I think that has been a phenomenal learning experience because I learn from everybody. I used to really like sitting in the open air canteen, which, by the way, is where I met you.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, we'd have chai, we'd have samosas, we'd have whatever else. And we'd chat and we'd, you know, I would learn, hopefully they would learn something from me. And I'm in touch with a large number of them. So even guys who I met, let's say, 12, 13, 14, 15 years ago, I'm in touch with them and we still keep meeting. So I think that's been the biggest plus point. What, you know, the group of students, and they're very good students. Fortunately, MDI is an excellent institution, right? Had it been an average place, I probably would not have felt so happy. But here, I've always been with great students, very bright guys, very often questioning me and very often proving me wrong. And that's a lot of fun because, you know, they prove me wrong. They ask me a question I have no answer to. I get back. I do a little bit of studying. Next day, I get back to them and say, look, this is, I think, what it should have been. So I think it's been a great experience.
Okay. What all roles have you played at MDI? Like what kind of work does it involve?
So teaching obviously is a key part of it, and I think that's been the most fun.
What courses?
So my background is IT, since I spent 20 years in NIT. So I would teach courses in IT, which would be things like data warehousing, business intelligence. Then I would teach things like MIS is a standard course, which all of us teach. Then I would teach things like CRM. I would also, given my NIS experience, I used to teach a course on business development in the IT industry. Right? But I think, so all these are in the past. In the last 6 years, I have now moved almost 800% into startups. So the most fun courses I've been teaching for the last, I think, X years now, have been courses like creating digital startups or fintech, because that's been what I'm doing, what I've been doing in the last 5-6 years, and that's what I live, breathe, eat, sleep, etc., etc., and that's what I do now.
So before we come to your journey as an angel investor, how does one create a course where nothing standardized exists? For example, if you want to create a course on fintech or on building a digital startup, there is no course which already exists from where you can get a table of contents and then, you know, have, like, say, marketing. You know, okay, there's Philip Kotler, there are 4 P's and stuff like that. But how did you go about creating these courses for which there was no template as such?
Okay, so first of all, that's the only reason why I did this. Had there been a template, had there been a textbook, I would probably not have been interested, right? So, so let me explain how it happened. So if you look at CDS, which is creating digital startups, or fintech, I would put them in the same category, right? So now I have spent a lot of time mentoring, investing in startups. And therefore, what I did was I picked up a lot of my cases, right? And each of these cases became a kind of session. So, you know, what happened, what went right, what went wrong. From there, I would create a framework. Look, this is what typically you need to do to be able to create a successful startup. And then I would put students, I normally try to make these sessions a little interactive. So I would put these students in the shoes of an angel investor. Okay, look, this is the background, this is the website, and you can ask me a few questions. Assume I am the founder. Now you tell me, would you invest in this or would you not? And why or why not? Right? So I would create my courses entirely out of my own personal experience. Right? Even before this, you know, the earlier courses I did in IT, whether it's in MIS or CRM or whatever, even those were based on my consulting experience. So most sessions were done around some client where something happened. I created a session or a game or something out of that, and I did that. I would imagine that initially they were probably not very structured, and you're absolutely right. But I think each session had a fair amount of learning because it was based on not only real life, it was based on my real life. You know, I believe very strongly, Akshay, a thing like engineering, you can teach from textbooks, right? But management, how the hell can you teach from textbooks? How can a faculty come into the room and say, look, this is a case which happened in the US. Now, please comment on it. I mean, the faculty should have actually physically gone through something himself. So I think it has to be personal experience. And to that extent, I only use personal experience. I would probably agree that ultimately my courses would probably not be as structured as some of the other courses that are taken. A. B. They probably had less content, but I think they had a lot more realism and a lot more actual experience. And typically that's the feedback I used to get. Look, you've given a lot of real life examples, and that is what we've learned. So fortunately, you know, even students, when they pass out, alums, they've got back to me and said, look, I'm working on this project, and you remember that session you took? I'm learning from that. You know, so that's very rewarding. Yeah. So it may not be the best, but it's basically my own experience. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how did your journey as an angel investor start?
Ah, now you've come to the fun part. Well, it's all been fun, by the way. But this is the most fun part. So I must tell you, I'm 65 now and I've just retired from MDI, but my career is just beginning. And I mean, I have a lot of fun every day. So how did it start? First of all, it actually started with MDI students. And in some cases, students who'd passed out and therefore were alums. So because I had experience in industry, and because I had worked as a consultant, a lot of these youngsters used to say, look, sir, I have this idea. I want to create a startup out of this. And I said, wonderful, let's sit. And we used to typically sit in the open air cafeteria and discuss it, right? Then gradually, some of these guys used to actually create their startup, okay? And then they say, look, I've already created it. So I used to get involved and I would keep advising them. Now, I realized something very, very fascinating. And I've been an investor in the stock market, right, for many, many years. I think about 35 odd years, right? But when I invest in the stock market, so let's say I invest in Reliance or Hindustan Lever or whatever, TCS. There is no way in hell I invest and that's it. I have no other connection with the company. There is no way in hell I can sit across the table with either Mukesh Ambani or Chandrasekharan or, you know, anyone of the, or Anand Mahindra and say, boss, now let us discuss your strategy. You tell me what you're doing. I'll give you advice. Let's figure out jointly kya karna hai. Right? Obviously, I can't. I mean, I invest and that's the end of it. So, investment in the stock market is a money-making affair, but there is no involvement, there is no learning. Except, you know, you learn how to pick the right stocks and so on and so forth. But when I spent time with all these students, I realized this is a place where I can actually be involved. Right? So, I spoke to a friend of mine and he put me in touch with somebody. In fact, put me in touch with a guy called Sushanto Mitra, who is the founder and CEO of Lead Angels Network, right? And he says, look, we have an angel network. Why don't you come and attend our meeting? So I landed up there with my checkbook. And on the spot, I gave a check. I said, I'm becoming a member, right? And I became an angel investor. And this was about 6.5 years back. And I think I was the quickest post-attending meeting to joining. The quickest. Because I said, boss, this is what I want to do. And I started investing. I haven't made money, by the way. I started investing, but I had such fun and there was so much learning because, you know, these were companies. I said, look, this is my company and I'm going to figure out, along with the founder, of course, how to take it forward. So it was terrific involvement. It was a lot of fun. It was a hell of a lot of learning. And I keep spending time with youngsters, right? So I think my purpose as an angel investor, my primary purpose is not to make money. My primary purpose is to be involved. So today, I mean, I have, let's say, 8 companies which I have invested in. 4 I invested in earlier, they have collapsed, but 8 which are currently going. And these are my companies. So I'm actually involved, right? Which I cannot be in the case of Reliance. So I think that's my primary purpose. And it's been a terrific journey. I mean, absolutely no regrets losing money, whatever money I lost, but it's been a terrific journey.
So how much should be like your kind of net worth or savings for you to think of becoming an angel investor? Like, you know, what kind of corpus did you start with? And did you leave aside something as like retirement savings and invest the rest in angel investing? Or like, what was the approach you took?
So I think this is something which anybody who's listening to this podcast and anybody who's planning to get into angel investing has to be very clear about. When I got into this angel investing, it was very, very clear. See, angel investing is a very high risk business. Right? You may latch on to that one guy who ultimately becomes a Byju's or a, you know, Ola Cabs or a whatever, Flipkart or whatever. But the chances of that happening are not very high, A. B, the chances of at least some of these investments that you made collapsing is actually fairly high. So out of the 12 odd investments I have made, I would say 4 died, they collapsed, the company had to close down. About 5 or 6 are doing okay, right? And only 2 are doing fairly, very well. In fact, very well, I would say. Right? So it's a very high risk, high gain kind of business. So very clearly, everybody, nobody should put in more than X percent of his corpus into this. So I have been very, very clear. I do not put in more than 5%. 5 is my upper limit. And I must tell you, Akshay, by the way, I am lowering my voice. My wife doesn't know this. You know, when a company closes down, right? My see, there is no concept of market value in the case of startups, right? If you're in a listed company, obviously there is a market value which is decided by the stock exchange, which is decided by the trades on the stock exchange, right? So the only value we have is the amount we've invested, right? So when a company dies, collapses, the value of that company comes down from the 5 or 6 or 8 lakhs I invested to zero. And because it comes down to zero, suddenly I have more space to invest. So I'm actually quite excited when a company dies. I get a chance to invest all over again. So very clearly, anybody who wants to get into this has to appreciate that it's a risky business. It has to be only money that you can afford to play around with, which you can afford to completely lose. Yes, you may not lose. You may actually, one of them or two of them may become huge multi-baggers, but be prepared to lose all of it, which is why, you know, guys like me, not more than 5%. And even, you know, rich guys, they also don't go beyond about 10%. The rest is in property or, you know, stock market or fixed deposits or debt funds or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And how much money should you have with you as a corpus? Like, if I have 5 lakhs, does that mean I can become an angel investor? Because there would be some minimum investment size that you would need to do.
Typically, so I'll explain how this thing works. Typically, when you invest in a company like this, no founder wants too many investors, right? Because when you have too many investors, it becomes very difficult to manage. And, you know, we have the concept of what we call a cap table, right? The capitalization table, which means how many shareholders does the company have and what shareholding does each person have. Now, when you raise the next round of investment, right, or the even the subsequent round, the VC who's coming in, the venture capitalist who's coming in, he says, look, boss, I don't want to invest in a company where there are so many tucha investors, right? Somebody's put in 2 lakhs, somebody's put in 1 lakh, somebody's put in 50,000, and there are 60 of them. I can't manage them. I want all of them to get out. Or if they are not willing to leave, I'm not willing to invest, right? So companies are not willing to take on less than a certain amount. And usually, the lower limit for any one company as an angel investor will be 5 lakhs. But there are networks which also take 3 lakhs. But lower than 3, I have not seen. So, you know, if you have a corpus, if you can invest only a total of 5 lakhs, yes, you can do it in one company. But ideally, you know, you should, since it's a very high-risk business, ideally, your investment, correct, should be diversified. So, I would say, you should look at angel investing if you have a corpus of at least about 20, 25 lakhs, which is play money for you.
Right. Okay. Right?
So that's my view.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what thesis did you form as an angel investor? And that thesis obviously would have become a part of your course at MDI also. But, you know, for the listeners who are aspiring founders of startups, you know, what kind of thesis do you have? Like, what should be an approach to starting a organization, and, you know, what will scale, what will not scale? What are your thoughts on that?
So I have written 4 books so far. And the latest one is what I call Funding Your Startup and Other Nightmares, right? And by the way, this and other nightmares is the bottom line of potentially a series. So, you know, the next one could be HR issues or people issues in startups and other nightmares. They could be one on growth pangs in startups and other nightmares, and so on and so forth, right? So, and other nightmares, it's like, you know, the dummy series. So, this is an other nightmare series, right? And this, by the way, is published by Penguin. So, what we've done is we have learned a hell of a lot from this journey. Sorry, I also should have mentioned, I have a co-author, His name is Sushanto Mitra. He is, I told you, the founder director and CEO of Lead right. Angels. Correct.
Right.
I am
right,
also
right.
a director. He is the CEO. Right. So, we have learned a hell of a lot, and we made a lot of blunders, a lot of mistakes, and I can share some of these mistakes. So what we've learned is that, you know, startups who become successful typically follow certain common themes. They take care of certain common things, and startups which are failures normally, you know, lose out on one or more of these, right? So that's number one. Number two, investors also have exactly the same thoughts. And I'm talking of any investor, whether angel or VC or whatever. So, and that theme we have tried to encapsulate in a framework that I call persistent, right? The word persistent, which is an acronym, PERSISTENT. So I'll just explain to you what this framework stands for, because each letter actually stands for something that the founder has to take care of, right? So P, I may not take it in order, or maybe I'll take it in sequence. So P stands for problem, which means you have to be solving a genuine problem for the customer. Otherwise, obviously, nobody comes to you. And if you go back to the NIS example, for the employer, we were solving a problem, but for the student, we were not, because he didn't want this, right? So we were not solving a problem for him. So that's the first thing, P. If you don't have a problem that you're solving, obviously, you cannot succeed. Second is what I call earnings model, which is somebody going to be willing to pay you? How do you make your revenues? What are your costs? And therefore, what's the gap between the revenue and the cost, right? So ultimately, there has to be an earnings model. Three is size of the market, right? Because obviously, you know, why people would create startups is they want to create something big, something unique, something disruptive. Now, if you have a tiny market, then obviously you can't do that, right? So size of the market becomes extremely important. The other important issue is scalability, right? Because not only should the size of the market be large, but you should be able to scale up rapidly. And, you know, two, three things we realized. The more digital your business is, for example, your business, Akshay, is largely digital. It's a highly scalable business, right? But the more the manual involvement, and therefore the more employees you need to add, the less the scalability, right? Similarly, if you have a product business, so for example, Microsoft, is a very highly scalable business because it's a product business. Whereas Infosys is not, because Infosys, if you have to double your revenue, you have to double your manpower, which means you have to double your infrastructure, machines, buildings, etc., etc. So it's not a scalable business, right? So we look at scalable businesses. Then the other issue is risks, because obviously every business has risks. And one of the biggest risks we have is obviously the threat of competition. And what we try and do here is we try and check for entry barrier. So that's the E in persistence. So by the way, I've talked about P, I've talked about E, I've talked about the two S's and R, which is risk. And now I come to the entry barrier. So essentially, that's, you know, what in your MBA lingo, you would call a moat. So what is it? Can you do something within your business so that it becomes a barrier to your competitor entering the same business and therefore potentially eating into your market share and maybe even killing you, right? So that's entry barrier. So the next thing is I, which stands for innovation. And obviously, if you have a highly innovative solution which is not copyable, then obviously that's a great entry barrier. And if you have a patent or two, that's even better, because then even legally, you are protected, right? So it's very important to make sure that you have an entry barrier. And innovative solutions, obviously, which are not copyable, are a very good example of an entry barrier. Then we have what I call niche. N stands for niche. So, you know, when you talk about size of the market, sometimes you find the market size is very large. But it's a very, very crowded space. You have lots and lots of players, including huge guys. I'll give you an example. So, for instance, if you look at the space of, you know, where you offer financial services and products digitally, right? Which means you offer like insurance online, correct, Policy Bazaar. Insurance online, buy and sell mutual funds online, take loans online, and so on and so forth. Now, that's a huge space, huge, where everybody does this. But the problem is it's hugely crowded because you have huge guys, right? You got Policy Bazaar, you got Paytm Money, you got ET Money, you got Bank Bazaar, Paisa Bazaar, Zerodha. So all these big guys are there, right? So for a new startup to get in, it's a pain. You can't survive in the presence of all these big guys. So what we say is, if you're in a highly crowded space, try and identify a non-crowded subset of that space, but it has to be large enough. Otherwise, again, you know, there's no point in getting in. And that subset is what we call a niche. So it's a niche market, but a large enough niche. And I'll give you a very simple example. One of the startups that I was involved in, unfortunately, I didn't invest in it. It's called Squirrel. Spelling is S-Q-R-R-L. So they are exactly in this space, right? Where they help you to get loans, they help you to get insurance, they help you to invest in mutual funds and so. And they actually also do some kind of wealth management for the common man, right? So what a typical wealth manager would do, they would do for the common man. But it's a highly, highly crowded space. So what they realized was the subset of this space, which is youngsters, you know, people who are either still in college or maybe in their first or at best their second jobs, guys under 30, they have not yet got into the habit of saving, investing, you know, putting money into mutual funds, taking loans, insurance products. So they focused only on the youngster space, right? And I think that's a great idea because that space itself is about 10 to 12 crore people if you look at the middle class, right? So they identified a very large but non-crowded niche, and I would expect that in this niche, they could become potentially one of the market leaders, right? So that's N. And then I have the last two letters, which is T and T. So the first T stands for team, which means basically starting with the founders, right? Because the team starts and ends, well, not ends, but starts with the founders. And we very strongly believe, and I think all investors, all founders have realized this, if you have even an average business plan and you have a great founder, he will figure out a way to pivot, modify the business plan and make it work. But if you have a great business plan but the wrong founder, it will fail. It is bound to fail, right? So team becomes extremely important. In fact, at early stages, the investor looks more at the founder than the business because the business can change. You have no idea. You basically identified a big space, but the right guy will probably be likely to make a success of it, right? So that leaves only one, which is traction, which is, you know, the proof of all this. You may have a great business idea, terrific earnings model, very high scalability, but the ultimate proof is, boss, dhanda aa raha hai ki nahi? Are you actually getting money? Are you actually getting customers? Are they increasing month on month, quarter on quarter? So that is traction. So that's the ultimate proof of all this. And that summarizes my persistent model. So what we've done in the book actually is that we have taken a lot of stories, which is from our own experience. It's once again, you know, what I did in classes. All the startups which I have either invested in or have been involved in. And we analyze them from the persistent point of view. And by the way, before I conclude this persistent part, very interesting. Persistent is not only an acronym, it's also an English word, right? And that's extremely important. You've been an entrepreneur yourself, boss. You'll have so many ups and downs, more downs than ups, right? COVID has been such a phenomenal down for everybody. But you got to keep on and on and on at it. You can't give up. And I think that quality of persistence in founders is probably, I would say, passion and persistence. And passion would lead to persistence, right? I think that is one very, very key thing which makes people succeed in starting and running their venture, right? So that's essentially the, so that's the framework that we evaluate startups in. And that's the framework that even investors typically use.
Okay, so this was like an amazing masterclass on both investing and scaling up your startup.
And it's free. I haven't charged you.
Yes. But chai is due. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. But after COVID. Or maybe yes. I'll join you in Japan and we'll have sushi.
That sounds great, sir. Okay. So, why did you leave MDI? What this is something which you were doing on the side. So, what made you want to stop the academic part of life?
Actually, and... I haven't left. I retired. So I retired.
You reached that age where it was
so like, 65 is our retirement age, and now they have no policy where they give extensions. And in any case, I was so heavily into startups. So I have now joined Lead Angels formally. And it's more of an advisory role. It is not a 9-to-9 operations role. So it gives me a lot of time to do what I like to do, which is writing books, writing articles, etc., etc. I, by the way, have a column in Your Story, which I'm going to start now. So I haven't really left. But I will keep going back to MDI and I'll keep... meeting students like you, youngsters like you. And I'll keep learning from you guys. So I haven't left. I don't leave places. I've only left one company in my life, which is NIT.
right. Amazing. Mm-hmm. So what is your advice for somebody who's looking to approach Lead Angels for fundraise? You know, how do you think they should think about it? How should they prepare for it?
So, by the way, I do a hell of a lot of webinars right now, lots of webinars. And one of the webinars I do, and these are all live and they're all free, incidentally, and they're all based on my book. So, one of the webinars I do is called How Fundable. Fundable actually is not a valid English word. So, I put a hyphen between fund and able, right? So, how fundable is your startup? Because, so on LinkedIn, otherwise, as in MDI, on my email, I keep getting lots and lots of requests for people who, want mentoring, they want to raise funds, they want money and so on and so forth. So I do these webinars and I tell them, boss, you attend this webinar and especially this one, how fundable is your startup? And within that, what I do is I cover one story. So typically, I will cover a story like the squirrel story I just told you. And after that, I talk about this framework, the persistent framework. And then each of the guys who participates in the webinar, I actually spend about 10, 12 minutes or 15 minutes sometimes analyzing and giving him advice on his startup, right? So everybody gets a chance to present to me. And I analyze that startup. In the process, by the way, I learn a hell of a lot. So that's one great way because I tell him honestly, look, right now you're not fundable. Maybe because you don't have enough traction or maybe you don't have an entry barrier or maybe you're in a very, very crowded space. So it could be any one of these, any one of these factors within persistent or it could be beyond that, right? Maybe the marketing plan you have is not right. Maybe you have to rethink. Okay, so that's one category. And those who are fundable, then I put them up to Lead Angels and potentially they get put up for funding, right? So that is one approach. The other approach is, obviously, if you're not attending this webinar, no issues. In fact, if you want to apply to an angel network, they're all listed, right? Sorry, not listed. They're all on the net. So... they will all have an email where you can submit your application. But please keep in mind two or three things. Number one, today, increasingly, angel investors are looking for traction. There was a time, in fact, that's been a hell of a lot of learning on our part. So initially, we used to invest based on excitement. Boss, kya idea, phenomenal, wonderful. But we lost money, right? So I am a very different kind of angel investor. I'm very happy even when I lose money, and you know that. But most angel investors, obviously, their primary purpose is to make money. I'm not saying I like losing money, but that's not my primary purpose. So because they want to make money, they have learned over the years that you need some level of proof. So now, increasingly, investors are demanding some level of traction and a decent level of traction. That is number one. And typically this traction, of course, I don't know if giving a figure here is makes sense or not, but it should be at least about 7-8 lakhs of revenue in a month, right? That's typically the kind of traction you're looking at. Of course, if you're in a very, very low margin business where your margins are only about 5-6%, then your revenue will need to be a lot higher, right, for that traction to be acceptable. Then, yeah, I would say if you look at this the persistent framework and measure yourself against this, you will hopefully on your own figure out. For example, many people, they don't even bother about looking at competition. They believe that their startup is unique. Frankly, it is not. Lots of people have the same idea. Lots of people have done something similar, right? So entry barrier becomes extremely important. How are you unique? How are you different, right? Many people do not look at scalability of their model, right? So they have too much manual involvement. Now, you've got to convert that into more and more automation. Otherwise, you're not scalable. So I would say, of course, this is my model, persistent, but you know, every investor ultimately uses something like this, even though the terms may be different, right? But ultimately, these are what are required for a successful business. So I would say, evaluate yourself against this. If you want, attend my webinar. You're most welcome. And of course, if you have 350 rupees to spare, buy my book. Well, that's available on Amazon and Flipkart.
Absolutely. And the link will be in the show notes. So, how important is it for a founder to make a business plan? Because, you know, being a founder myself, I have always struggled to do any sort of number-based business plan. Okay, we'll hit this number next year, or we'll hit this number in year two, this number in year three, because things are so fluid. And there's so many assumptions you make, which are 90% of your assumptions end up being off the mark. So,
absolutely, you know. I agree. I fully agree. So, first of all, when I say business plan, one very, very important thing, the business plan, many founders assume the business plan is something you have to create because the investor wants to look at it. And after that, once you got the money, forget about it. I think that's a huge mistake because you've got to have a business plan for the business, not for the investor. Yes, the investor will also want to look at it, but ultimately a business cannot just be action and more action and more action. There has to be a purpose. There has to be a direction, right? So that is number one. Number two, I would say, what does the business plan include? Incidentally, my book includes one chapter on the business, in fact, two chapters on the business plan. And how to create the business plan. So this persistent thing is the core of the business plan, right? What's the problem you're trying to solve? How will you make money? What are the risks? Who are the competitors? What's the innovation? What's the entry barrier, etc., etc., right? So that's one part. Then the other part is what you rightly mentioned, the numbers. And there the numbers would be whatever you've achieved in the past, if any, plus whatever you expect to achieve in the future. I think you're absolutely right. The numbers by themselves are not critical because as a founder, you know, everything changes, assumptions change. I'll give a very simple example, boss. You know, a lot of people got into the payment business, right? Now, suddenly the RBI changed the rules and said, okay, the MDR, which is the merchant discount rate on RuPay card. So RuPay card, they said we will proliferate. And the MDR, which is the merchant discount rate, which is the amount that is paid, that will be zero. Now, suddenly, guys who were in this business said, hang on, what is this? So, everything keeps changing all the time. And quite frankly, if you are in a business which is not changing dramatically, it is probably not suited to startups because startups are, by definition, nimble. You know, they can change, whereas companies like ITC and Hindustan Lever cannot change, right? So you're absolutely right. Things are very volatile. Things will change, and that's to the benefit of startups, which as against these large, stable, solid, you know, slow-moving companies. So, but you still must make some, still must project some numbers. I think what is more important than the numbers is the assumptions. And the key is, are your assumptions well thought out? Are your assumptions based on some reality? Have you done some kind of validation in the market? So, for example, in NIS, we had done validation where we checked with companies and we did some level of validation as to what is the fresher level sales recruitment required in the industry. And those numbers were huge. But where we missed out was we hadn't validated it with students, because we assumed just because you're getting into a good company, great salary, you will be interested, right? So numbers are important, but I think even more than important than the numbers is the assumptions and ideally validated assumptions, right? But you're right, you must be 100% prepared to keep relooking at these numbers on a very, very regular basis and revisiting your assumptions. And incidentally, even investors, they will not, you know, they will not hold you to ransom if you've not met your numbers, because they realize the numbers are, I mean, they're just figures in the sky. We don't know whether they will be met or not. But they look at your assumptions. They look at whether you understand the reasons behind these numbers or not. But they also realize the numbers will change dramatically. So the fact that the numbers will change dramatically, like I said, is to the benefit of the startup as compared to the solid, stable companies. But that does not mean you should not have numbers. You must have numbers. Be prepared to visit them again and again. So that's my take on a business plan.
So what are some best practices that you would like to recommend to founders for managing investors?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I will talk about two stages. One is the stage before you get the investment, and two is after you get the investment, right? So I'll do it in two parts. So before you get the investment, what are things that the investors look for, and therefore what you have to be careful about? Of course, one is, you know, my persistent model, whatever other terms they might use for this. But there are certain other things that they look for, and they certain things that they frown upon. So first of all, any investor who is what I would call a pheku, you know, a guy who keeps bragging, right? Nobody likes that. Every investor wants people to back up whatever he's saying with facts, right? So don't brag. Don't claim things that you don't have. Be very clear that, you know, investors can catch you, because they're smart guys, right? And normally, investors will get together in a bunch, right? It will not be, you know, one guy talking to you. It will be 30, 40, 50, 60, sometimes 100 guys in a meeting. And there will be enough people who are in the same sector as you. So they will know what's going on, right? So don't do that, number one. Don't fool the investor, because the moment you fool the investor, I think that is the end of your opportunity. If you don't have an answer, if there is a problem, be honest. Tell them you don't know, but it's a thought which you need to look at. Or, you know, if there is a weakness in your thing, be upfront. Talk about weaknesses, because investors appreciate frankness. Because, you know, ultimately these are partnerships, right? So that's number two. Number three, one thing which investors obviously look for is attention to detail. So, you know, anybody who's superfluous normally doesn't go down well. So these are things which the founder needs to look at pre-funding. Post-funding, I think one, the most important things, these things are still valid, by the way. The first three are still valid. I think one very important issue is communication. Because, you know, investors have put in their hard-earned 5 lakhs or 10 lakhs into your company. And, you know, you cannot sit quiet and let the investors get restless, only then tell them what the hell is going on. So the best startups that I have are the ones where I get a monthly report. Sorry, not a monthly, a quarterly report. So I get a quarterly MIS. These are the numbers. These are the numbers compared to last quarter. These are the pluses. These are the minuses. This is the work in progress. This is what I hope to close. Brilliant, because within those two pages, I get a snapshot of what's happening, and then we hold an investor call. Right? Whereas there have been founders who just keep mum, because, you know, they feel their job is to run the business and not to brief investors. But that's wrong, because these guys are your partners, and investors can help you very solidly. So you know, the investor not only helps you for money, they help you with contacts, they help you with mentorship, they help you with all the wisdom that hopefully they have gained over the years. So if you don't talk to them, if you don't tell them what the hell is going on, how will you benefit from this? So the benefit is not only money, the benefit is also A, contacts, and B, wisdom. So communication, regular communication becomes extremely important. I think the other very, very important thing is founders must realize, and fortunately most founders do realize that it's ultimately a partnership. It has to be a win-win. And ultimately both of them have the same aim, which is the company should do well. Don't assume that the investor is now your enemy. You know, he's putting pressure on you. He's piling onto you. He's saying, boss, ye kyun nahi diya? Yaar, let me run my business, boss. Don't keep pestering me all the time. He's your partner. He's your well-wisher. And ultimately, you have the same goal. So, please assume that you are on the same side of the table. And the interest that you have is also the same interest that the investor has. So, let's work together. I think that's one of the most important things.
Okay. So, sir, my last question to you. Who are some of the thought leaders that you are inspired by? People whose either you like to watch their videos or read their books and gain wisdom from?
Okay. So, the thought leaders, by the way, the thought leaders I have been inspired by are founders. They're founders who have actually run successful companies. And I will mention two or three of them. I would say Sanjeev Bikhchandani, who is the founder of Naukri, which I imagine is your competitor. I don't know.
Not really, sir.
No?
Okay. In fact, last week, we released our podcast episode with him. So, we are more in a human service business.
Okay. So, Sanjeev Bikhchandani, the founder and I think vice chairman of InfoEdge, which includes Naukri, which includes, I think, Jeevan Sathi and maybe... they've also invested in Policy Bazaar and Zomato and so on. That's one. The other guy is Deep Kalra, the founder of Make My Trip. And the third guy is a very interesting guy who is not very, I mean, he's not too much of a public figure. His name is Dinesh Agarwal. He is the founder of India Mart, which is by far the market leader in B2B. So it's something like the B2B equivalent. It's a little like Alibaba, or it's the B2B equivalent of Amazon, right? Except that they are more into listing rather than completing transaction. So I'll just share with you a couple of things that these guys, I've learned from these guys. Incidentally, all three are, they have a chapter each in my book. Dinesh Agarwal, I'll share with you one quote from him. He says, why do people chase growth at any cost? Why do people chase valuations, right? You know, all these large so-called successful startups which are getting more and more rounds of funding, Series F, Series G, etc., etc., valuation going up to 4 billion, 10 billion and beyond. They're loss-making, many of them. So he says, and I'll quote from him, he says, gaadi tez chalana ek nasha hai, right? But petrol jab khatam ho jayega, aap kya karoge?
Yeah,
so right. This is growth at any cost, growth in a loss-making business. Suppose tomorrow funding stops, where the hell are you? You're finished, right? So he was very clear in his business. He was very clear, it has to be a viable business from day one. And he has not had growth at any cost. He has not had spectacular growth, by the way. He's had steady growth. But he's profitable, right? And I think, and by the way, he's listed. So it's a very, very good share to buy because I think I really respect the guy for his views. So that's one. The other guy, of course, is Sanjeev Bikhchandani. He made one brilliant statement where he says, the customer's money is far better than the investor's money. Because if you're getting the customer's money, that means you're doing something right. And if you're getting the customer's money, and you need the investor's money, you will get the investor's money. But if you only get the customer, the investor's money, and you're not getting the customer's money, investor bhi baad mein paisa nahi dalega. Right? So I think that was one great comment from him. And I will give you one comment from Deep Kalra as well, where he says, you know, here I'm saying in my persistent model, I talk about problem, right? The first, the P in persistent. He says, be a anacin for the customer, not a vitamin, right? Anacin means you are actually taking care of a pain point, right? Because anacin is a pain reliever. If you're a vitamin, it's a nice to have thing. A nice to have thing may or may not succeed. But if you're solving this pain point, you're much more likely to succeed. So I think, you know, these three statements more or less summarize what I've learned from these guys. And I think these are three guys I really respect for their attitude.
So that was Professor Dhruv Nath talking about building startups. If you want to get your hands on the wisdom of Professor Dhruv Nath, then do check out his book, Funding Your Startup.
Beyond Campus is a production of ThePodium.in, powered by Career Launcher. If you like this show, then we are sure that you will love our other shows on subjects like entrepreneurship, marketing, books, and drama. Check out ThePodium.in for a complete list of all our shows.